for me to let people make their mistakes and let people commit their sins and stand, you know, at a distance and kind of tisk, tisk, tisk and just let it go. Like it doesn't have anything to do with my world. Like it doesn't have anything to do with me. And that's just not a reasonable, that's not a proper approach for a Christian with regard to anger. So what I did this week, and I alluded to this in my Facebook this last week, maybe some of you caught that. I did a little exercise. I put together a list of anger passages. And what I mean by that is I tried to think of things that make us, as you know, American humans in the 21st century, what make us angry, or what oftentimes seem to be making us angry. Make a list of those kind of things and see if those sort of things came across Jesus' path. Did Jesus encounter any of those kind of things? And then try to make a list of things that did in fact make Jesus angry. Things that were proper cause for anger. And I'll put one list on one side of the paper, and I'll put the other list on the other side of the paper, and we'll see what happens. And that was literally the entire plan. And I know over the last 7 years or so, you've gotten used to me doing the whole point one, point two, point three, stand and sing kind of outline sermon. That's what I do. 90% of my sermons are like that. This one is not like that. This one is simply a compare and contrast. What makes us angry and what makes Jesus angry? So let me give you a list number one here. And you have a little shell to follow along with here, and I would encourage you to do so as you have opportunity on the left side of the page if you haven't figured that out. Ask yourself, what is it that really inflamed Jesus' anger? And I'll give you a few examples of things that might make us angry. And ask yourself in passing, and we'll come back and deal with these more specifically as we go, did these kind of things get Jesus angry, typically? Racism, for instance. Everybody's angry about racism these days, right? Broad classes of people hating broad other classes of people simply because they're different, because they have different skin color or whatever. A lot of anger about racism. Personal finances. Being angry about the boss, about the job, about the career, about the state of the economy, whatever. General poverty. Maybe not my own situation, but the situation of a lot of other people in our town, in our country, certainly in the world. There are a lot of people who are in a really, really bad situation. That gets people very, very worked up. Ill treatment of good people. There are a lot of very noble people, honorable people, godly people, Christian people, who are suffering oftentimes because they are these things, because they are good, because they are Christians. That's not right. That gets us worked up. Unreasonable taxes. This goes all the way back to Boston, right? 1773. We get very, very worked up about unreasonable taxes. Some of us get worked up about taxes, period. But especially if it's just, you know, outrageous. This is that time of year, after all. Many of us are kind of putting our little forms together We get excited about our refunds that are coming until we realize this is my money that government has finally gotten around to giving back to me. You know, that's aggravating to me. And it's aggravating to a lot of other people. Oppressive government, speaking of taxes and such, maybe in a more general sort of sense. The government is taking more and more of my, tyrannical sort of hand in my life. Personal tragedy, national tragedy, international tragedy, horrible, horrible things happening in the world. We hear about that a lot. The constant, or it seems like anyway, constant erosion of our own rights. Our rights as Americans, our rights as humans. It's not right that we see these things being taken away on a constant basis. We talk about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, all these kind of things. Talk about family problems. Maybe it's your mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister-in-law, daughter-in-law. Maybe it is your children. Maybe it's your parents, grandparents. Some kind of issue in your family that is just absolutely driving you to destruction. It's not your fault, of course. It's their fault. It's always their fault. That gets us angry. War, you know, those are bad things, right? We don't like war. And the idea that humankind would go out of its way to kill thousands and thousands of other humans, that's unthinkable. How in the world could we allow such things in the modern day? Well, here's some examples. And if you're on social media very much,
Now I'm on probably more than I should. You're treated to this kind of thing on an ongoing basis. You see what people are angry about these days. You see what people are upset about. And they'll tell you about it. And they'll tell you in no uncertain terms exactly how upset they are. In a very real sense, in a very broad sense, we are living in a very angry time in the modern day. Well, did Jesus actually encounter these things? Well, it turns out he did. Jesus encountered racism. We read it a few moments ago, where they were going into the area of the Samaritans, and Jews were oftentimes not welcome among the Samaritans, and they weren't welcome this time. And James and John had one approach to that situation, and Jesus had quite another. James and John wanted to call down fire from heaven and blow away all the bad guys. Maybe the solution is just to kill all the bad people. They're racist. They were racist before we were. You know, they were bad people before we were bad people. We're justified in this. They hate us simply because of who we are. They hate us because we're Jews. Well, let's kill them then. But Jesus doesn't get worked up about it, does he? We have to walk a few miles out of our way. We'll walk a few miles out of our way. We'll do that. Jesus did not get engaged. Personal finances. Jesus told people who would follow after him, the Son of Man has not where to lay his head. How many times do you hear Jesus complaining about personal poverty? Do you ever think about Jesus being a homeless person? A person who, and there were times that he here had what appears to be a relatively stable existence. There are places that are referred to as the house or his house. But on an ongoing basis, that wasn't Jesus' lifestyle. He certainly was not rich by any stretch of the imagination by the standards of his day. Would have been in the common class, which is to say what we would call the poor class. But he didn't get worked up about it. He did not go out and find a second or a third job. General poverty. A lot of people in a general sort of sense, that's supposed to be John chapter 14, by the way, or John chapter 12, and not Luke chapter 13. In John chapter 12, one of the really perplexing things that Jesus says, that really kind of drives us to distraction a little bit, where Judas has made this generous offer to take this money, this ointment that would have been worth an awful lot of money that's being squandered, he thinks, on the Lord. Let's put it in the bag. Put it in our cache of money that we're using to pay for our expenses, and we can use it to help poor people. And that's not Judas's actual attitude, of course. Judas had every intention of stealing whatever money he could out of that bag. But Jesus says, no, it's better for that money to be quote-unquote wasted on me than spent on the poor. And his rationale in verse number 8 of John chapter 12, for you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. Well, that strikes us a little bit insensitive. Jesus seems to be indifferent almost toward the plight of poor people. Now, I would argue that he's not being indifferent toward poor people. He is accepting the situation in life. He is accepting that there's always going to be poor people. We're not happy about that. We're not rejoicing over that. But we accept it as reality. Jesus accepted it as reality, and he did not get upset about it. And again, apologies for the typo there. Ill treatment of good people. Jesus calls them blessed when they're suffering. When you're being persecuted for righteousness' sake, that's the good life. That's what you should appreciate about life. When men revile you and persecute you, say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. That's a cause for joy, not a cause for anger, not a cause for getting worked up. Good people have always been afflicted. Good people have always been punished and will continue to be such. That is not, in Jesus' mind, a cause for lashing out in anger. Unreasonable taxes. There's one episode, actually, where Jesus is asked about paying the temple tax, and he kind of subtly points out to Peter the irony of all of this, the taxes to uphold the temple. The temple is being upheld so it can honor God. Well, I'm God in the flesh, so I'm paying to honor myself. It's kind of ridiculous, actually, to do this, but he goes ahead and pays his taxes anyway. A somewhat more familiar text in Matthew chapter 22, verse number 17 and following, where the propriety, I guess you would say, of paying taxes to this oppressive foreign government comes up. Jesus says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. We're not going to get worked up about taxation. Even oppressive taxation. And note here, taxation being levied by a government that was determined to keep the thumb on the heads of godly people. Roman was an oppressive government, a government that intended to be oppressive, that made no qualms about telling people how oppressive. They bragged about being oppressive, about taking away the people's rights so as to solidify their hold over these foreign nations. I don't think there's any reason to believe Jesus was happy about that or that he celebrated that, but he certainly did not lash out in anger against that. Oppressive government, speaking of unreasonable taxes and such, how about if some rebels were rounded up, chased into the temple, and slaughtered so close to the altar that their blood actually spilled out, human blood, onto the altar of God, which is the most profane of blasphemies. This happened. Pilate did it to some people. He describes it. Luke chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. And people were just assuming that this was some kind of earth-shaking kind of event. Surely this is just as bad as the Romans could possibly get. Or by contrast, surely these people must be as evil as they possibly could have been for God to have allowed this horrific death to come upon them. Jesus says, except your opinion, you'll all likewise perish. Does not get worked up about this crime, about this slaughter of his nation. He's more concerned about the current spiritual plight of the people who are still alive. More on that in a second. Tragedy, along the same lines. Sometimes it's not the government, sometimes it's just life. In that same context, in Luke chapter 13, he refers to this tower that fell in Siloam, which appears to have been an accident, or maybe what the insurance people would call act of God. The towers fell and killed people. And again, the assumption is someone who dies publicly, someone who dies on the front page of the newspaper, as it were, they must be worse people. Surely this is the way that God deals. And Jesus says, no. This is life. Bad things happen. The important thing is, you get your sight set on spiritual things and make sure that worse things do not befall you. There is, in fact, a greater tragedy, a much greater tragedy that Jesus sees on the horizon. He talks about a great deal that was going to come in AD 70, as it turns out, when the Romans would come and destroy the entire nation. And in an even greater sense, he alludes to a time when all the world is going to be punished for sin. Not just Jerusalem, not just Judea, but all of us. I'm kind of giving away the ending to some of this, but nevertheless. The erosion of our rights. What if we had the right to carry this Roman soldier comes and says, here, you have to carry this burden for me. You have to carry my lunchbox. I'm tired. You have to carry my lunchbox. And he asks, you have to carry it for a mile. That's what the law says. And so you do what you would typically do as an oppressed people. You go as slow as you can. You drop it and kick it a few times. And you just make it as obnoxious as you possibly can. So this guy is going to think twice about asking you for a favor again. And after that mile is done that you're required to go, you're done. You stop in mid-step. I'm finished. This is where I'm going to stop. And Jesus says, yes, you are oppressed. Yes, it's not reasonable for a human being to be treated the way you're being treated. But I say, go another mile. Someone slaps you on the face, you turn the other cheek. And I'm not sure that he's talking here about specifically how you deal with specific circumstances, but rather the attitude that you take toward oppression. This is not a cause for you to get angry. It's certainly not a cause for you to act less like a Christian, less like God's person. You act more like God's person in a situation like that. And that means controlling your anger, channeling it in a proper direction, not lashing out at some carnal thing. Family problems. Jesus says, you want to talk about family problems? Jesus had his own family problems, of course. His father apparently is not on the scene anymore. A lot of people think that he passed away before the events of Jesus' ministry. He's certainly not mentioned much. What we do have is his mother and his brothers and sisters. And the brothers and sisters, anyway, didn't care for Jesus very much. They didn't care for his ministry very much. And do we see Jesus complaining about his family? Do we see him complaining about how his mom doesn't support him, and they always take the little kid's side over me, and you know, things that we complain about in our family? Mom always liked you best. You know, okay. No. Jesus does not get worked up. In fact, he says, I'm going to create family problems. You come to me, you give me your service, you give me your discipleship, and you're going to find extra family problems. I came to set up father against son, mother against daughter, father-in-law against son, or mother-in-law against daughter-in-law. The foes of a man are going to be the foes of his own household, he says. Again, we're not celebrating that. We're not happy about that. But we're certainly not getting into anger over these kind of things. Even war. Jesus talks in a very dismissive way toward war. We're not happy about war. I'm sure Jesus wasn't happy about war. But a lot of people, in the context of Matthew chapter 24, we're going to see war and the stories about war as some kind of portent for imminent disaster. And he says, you're going to hear about wars and rumors of wars. It doesn't mean anything. That's what people do. If you've been reading a newspaper for the last, you know, whatever, 1,000 years, you've noticed this. People go to war. You know, we prefer economic war in the modern day. We think that's more civilized or whatever. Less bloodshed, less blood in the carpet. But it's still war. We're still warring against our fellow man. And we're not necessarily happy about that. We certainly don't like being on the receiving end of it. But we do not see Jesus lashing out at world affairs like this. We don't see him having these grand tirades from the mountaintop about how horrible society is. And you'll notice there is a bit of a pattern that we're looking at here. All these things that we've mentioned so far, these are, by and large, societal problems. That is to say, problems that are out there, problems in our community, problems that are in our nation, problems that are in the world. And they tend very strongly to be carnal problems, which is to say, problems in the flesh, problems of the world and problems of the world, basically what we're saying here. We're living in a physical world that has consequences, negative consequences for us. It had negative consequences for Jesus. But he did not lash out in anger about such things. Very consistently, he did not. In fact, I'm strapped for a single example of any time when Jesus got genuinely angry over a carnal matter. Now, we got another list prepared. And if you've listened to me preach at all for the last 7 years, you've probably figured out where we're going with this. We have a second list that is very, very different. A list that is characterized by individual problems, not societal problems. Problems with a person, more often problems with me. And spiritual problems. Problems that are not necessarily rooted in carnal things, but rather that are regarding the matters of the Spirit. And with regard to these kind of things, with regard to the way people, not people, but individual humans, the way that individual humans were acting, the way that they honored or dishonored God, that did make Jesus angry. And in fact, we see a lot of examples of this. John chapter 6, verse 26. When the people had been fed miraculously with the loaves and fishes after Jesus feeds them and goes across the sea, and they track him down the next day. And here's a great example, another opportunity for Jesus to give them another great feast and fire up the masses and accumulate an army for himself. And instead, he lashes out at them, essentially drives them away. You did not come to hear me. You came because you ate of the loaves and the fishes and were full. You came for the food. I don't want people who only came for the food. And in fact, he spends most of the latter part of John chapter 6 driving these people away with this crazy talk about bread of life and eating his flesh and drinking his blood and all this kind of crazy stuff that the average person is not going to listen to. Jesus knows they're not going to listen to it. And they leave. Well, why wouldn't they leave? This is what makes Jesus upset. Failure to forgive. Remember, Jesus tells this story about the fellow who owed this immense amount of money to his boss and couldn't pay it back and wanted to pay it back, and the boss just forgave the debt, brushed it off. And then he goes out and finds his buddy who owes him a handful of money, a very meager amount, something that could easily have been paid off with a little bit of patience. And he begs for patience, and no, absolutely not. He refused to forgive the debt. And although in the literal language of the parable, it's this man's boss, this man's overseer who is angry. You can tell it's Jesus' anger, really, that we're looking at. He's furious at this man who received this immense gift of grace and refused to forgive his neighbor, refused to forgive somebody else who owed him this little bit of money. This gets Jesus upset. Excuse making. Another parable, right? The great dinner. Here's this tremendous feast that Jesus, obviously, behind the scenes in the parable is trying to say. This immense feast has been prepared. I'm telling you about it. Here you are. Come and get it. I'm not going to do that. I've got this team of oxen I need to check out. I got this land that I bought. I need to check that out. I got married. You know, maybe the invitation didn't specifically say I could bring plus one, so I'm going to stay home. You know, whatever happens, I've got excuses. Well, I'm sure you do. We all have excuses. And the people that made excuses to Jesus saw Jesus' anger. Because this excuse making is really about priorities. It's saying, I don't value the dinner that you're giving me. I don't value this new life that you're offering to me. I care more about my physical concerns. But really, even more than that, I care less about your spiritual concerns. This gets Jesus upset. Indifference to others. This is one of the passages where the word angry actually occurs. We don't see that word used specifically to Jesus very often, but you see it here. In Mark chapter 3, Jesus has an opportunity to heal this man with a withered hand. And everybody's watching, because it's a Sabbath day. And apparently Jesus has acquired a bit of a reputation for not respecting the Sabbath like people think he ought to respect. And they see healing as being a work. And work in general terms is not permitted on the Sabbath day. Now, we could have a big discussion about whether it was work for Jesus to actually heal somebody. Clearly, Jesus didn't think it was. Jesus sees this as a mission of mercy. He sees a person who is in pain, a person who is struggling with life, with community, who is, to a certain degree, in a way, ostracized from proper society. I have an opportunity to help that person. And I'm going to help that person. And you're more concerned about this fiddly little argument about the Sabbath than an actual human being in pain. That sort of indifference to human beings, that enraged Jesus. Pursuing personal agendas. If there's one personal tirade that perhaps grabs our attention more than any other, maybe it's this one. Right after Peter has made this great confession in the coast of Caesarea Philippi, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus commends Peter for this and lifts him up and gives him the keys of the kingdom. And right after that, Jesus starts in very specific terminology to say how he was going to go to Jerusalem soon and that he was going to be killed and raised up on the third day. And Peter takes Jesus aside, the text says, and says, God forbid it, Lord, that will never happen to you. And he means the best. I have every confidence that Peter is trying to be supportive. He's trying to be encouraging and loving toward his best friend. I have no doubt of that at all. And Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. Now that may strike you as a little bit extreme, and maybe it is. But Jesus is prepared to get extreme in the proper circumstances. In this particular situation, it's because Peter, regardless of whether he realizes it or not, is prioritizing his own agenda, his own thoughts, his own preferences over what God has told him to do. The mere fact that Jesus said this is going to happen, it's a real shame it's going to happen, this is going to happen. And Peter says, no, we're not going to let that happen. That's all you need to know to tell you where Peter is in all of this. He has his own ideas about the kingdom. He has his own ideas about the king and his role in the kingdom. And this crucifixion business doesn't fit at all. So we're going to have to get rid of this crucifixion. And Jesus, the quicker you quit talking about this, the better, quite frankly. That is Peter prioritizing his own will, his own issues, his own agenda over the Lord's. Again, whether he realizes it or not, whether he's conscious of it or not, that's exactly what he's doing, and it makes Jesus furious. Binding man's laws. We know the argument that's given to us in Matthew chapter 15, verse 7 and following. In the specific case, it was the Corban law, or the Corban tradition. You have a dollar in your wallet, metaphorically speaking, and you go to your dad and you say, Dad, I know that you are poor and hungry and homeless and such, and this dollar would really go a long way to taking care of you, and I have an obligation under the law to honor my father and mother, but this dollar right here is going in the collection plate, and my obligation to God is more important than my obligation to my parents, and therefore this dollar that would have been yours is God's, and now I don't have to honor my father and mother anymore. Oh, and by the way, I got $100 in my pocket. That has nothing to do with it. This is creating laws and pretending like they're God's laws. God at no point said you could treat your parents like that. That was not implied. That was not expressed. It's nowhere in the text. Exactly the opposite, in fact. And Jesus says, in vain do they worship me, quoting from Isaiah, teaching as doctrines the precepts of men. They are making up their own laws and pretending like they're God's laws, and that made Jesus furious. And how many times do we do that? How many times are we guilty of condemning somebody for doing things that we personally don't like rather than what is actually condemned in Scripture? Hypocrisy. Over and over again in Matthew chapter 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees. What does he call them? Hypocrites. 7 times, I think, in that text. Hypocrites. Verse 16 is talking about the making of vows. I'm going to keep my vow if it's a vow based on the gold in the temple. But if it's just a vow according to the temple, well, that doesn't really count. I can pass on that. Well, we talked about that a little bit in our Bible class hour out here this morning. How seriously God took vow keeping. And what you do not say is, these are the important vows over here. This is the terminology for important vows over here. Use this terminology, then you're absolutely bound. And these other vows over here, well, those are good. You really ought to do those kind of things. But if you don't wind up doing them, well, you didn't use the proper terminology. That's probably okay for you to break those vows. Nothing remotely resembling that in the text. And by saying one thing is more important than the other and holding yourself up as noble because you support the important things, that's being a hypocrite, Jesus says. Hypocrisy drove Jesus crazy as well. Revelation chapter, you know, Jesus isn't done talking once he goes back to heaven. He comes back a few times, most notably in the book of Revelation. He comes back and speaks to John and gives 7 letters to him for the 7 churches in Asia. And for the church in Laodicea, we know this one fairly well. This church that was neither cold nor hot, the text says. I wish that you were cold or hot. But because you're not, because you're lukewarm, what's he going to do? He's going to vomit them up. Spew them out of their mouth. It makes me sick when I get so-called service that looks like this. And that makes me a little weak in the knees, quite frankly. And I hope it makes you a little weak in the knees too. Because how often have we been guilty of this kind of thing? How often have we made Jesus sick? Because of our lukewarmness. How passionate are we for spiritual things? Which is kind of the point of the whole lesson here, actually. How emotionally engaged do we get? How worked up do we get over spiritual things, over our own personal failures before the Lord? Earlier in the text, false teaching that's going on. And, you know, we wish it wasn't. We wish the preacher would teach the truth instead of teaching this error. Wish the Bible class teacher would stand for what's right instead of saying what he's saying. But, you know, hey, what are you going to do? We need to have peace in the church. We need to go along and get along. The churches, the churches at Pergamum and Thyatira that were guilty of these kind of tolerances. You know, we're used to thinking of tolerance as being just the ultimate good these days. Jesus was not a fan of tolerance. Not with regard to these things anyway. You don't tolerate error. If you do tolerate error, that makes Jesus angry as well. Abuse of worship. And maybe this is the first thing that you thought of when you thought about Jesus' anger. On two occasions, in John chapter 2 and again at the end of his ministry, Matthew chapter 21, Jesus lashes out, literally lashes out, against his contemporaries. People who had taken advantage of an economic oddity in first century Jerusalem. People who had traveled from great distances and this is mentioned in the law, actually. It may be that the obligation that you're bringing to the temple during the feast is just too big to travel with. And so what you do is you cash it in for money and you bring your money. And that's what people did, especially if they were traveling from Rome or Athens or whatever. And they would come to Jerusalem prepared to buy an offering. And the easiest place to do it would be on the temple grounds themselves. And there were these wide open concourses where people would conduct business, not the temple itself, not the actual holy place and the most holy place, but temple grounds, many of which were accessible to Gentiles. They would come into these places and there would be people who were selling would-be offerings at exorbitant fees, making money, using the opportunity that was given to them to not just provide a service, but to get rich doing it. To exploit people who were in an unfortunate and largely unavoidable circumstance. And Jesus drove them out, overturned their tables, drove away their livestock. We will not permit this. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. This is not about making money. This is not about promoting your own personal financial agenda. This is about serving God. And those who have forgotten that have forgotten everything that there is. Disciples' failure to grow. Now, I'll admit this is a bit of a burr under my saddle too sometimes. It's difficult to read anything other than frustration and anger into Jesus' voice when he talks to Philip. After he tells Philip and the rest of the disciples, I'm going to prepare a place for you. I'm going to be with my Father. You're going to come too. We don't know where to go. How do we know to get there? I'm the way, the truth, the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. You attach yourself to me and it's going to be okay. And under these circumstances, this is exactly when Philip decided to say, show us the Father and it suffices us. What we really want, Lord, speaking of the Heavenly Father, what we'd really like to do is see God. Now, I know that nobody ever has. Moses wasn't permitted to see the face of God. Elijah wasn't permitted to see the face of God. Abraham, all these. But we're your close friends. Maybe you could show us God. And Jesus says, have I been so long with you, Philip? How can you ask me this question? Anything relevant with regard to the Father, you've already seen. You've seen it in me. If you see me, you've seen the Father. How do you not get that now? On day one, when Philip and his friend Nathanael, who we assume is probably the same as Bartholomew, when they encounter Jesus, they don't know who Jesus is, and Jesus is able to tell them what Nathanael's been doing, what he's been thinking. That's a remarkable kind of thing. They don't know Jesus very well, but they know him enough to follow him. At that point, if Philip were to ask, show us the Father and it suffices us, that might make some sense. It'd still be wrong, but it would make sense. Philip's been following Jesus for 3.5 years now, and he still has no idea who Jesus is. That's not right. He should have grown more than that. Like the writer tells the Hebrew brethren, the end of chapter 5. You ought to be teachers of the law by now. God, the law of Christ, that is. And you have to come and have people teach you the very basic elements of what constitutes the most basic pablum. You don't understand that Jesus is everything you need. You don't understand anything about the gospel if you don't understand that. This is what inflames Jesus. And before we extend the invitation, I want to urge you and urge myself to follow Jesus' lead on this. And I'm not saying you need to quit watching the news or quit joining political movements or doing marches for this, that. I'm not saying that. You do what you want to do with your private life. None of my business. But if we cannot work up the kind of fervor, the kind of energy, the kind of emotional response for the things of Christ that we routinely, regularly, and unapologetically work up for our own things, there is something wrong in Israel. We can and we must do better than that. How can we be living in a sinful world, surrounded by everything in the world that's wrong, and be seemingly indifferent, and yet so very upset when something mundane goes wrong? I mentioned in the bulletin a couple of weeks ago about some football fans suing the NFL because one call was wrong and therefore they thought their team was robbed of a chance to go. Not they missed the Super Bowl. Their team missed the Super Bowl. They were not robbed in the slightest, but they were put out. They were really angry. Well, what are we going to do? Well, we're going to do something about it. We're going to find something to do about it. Well, I admire somebody who has the kind of passion that would exert themselves in that kind of direction over such a ridiculous and pointless cause. They feel so passionately about it that they're willing to engage in a completely fruitless and pointless effort simply because they care. Do we do that about Jesus? And do we do that about our carnal things? I urge you, as I am examining myself, to do the same kind of thing. To use the aftermath of our gospel meeting. And as we look forward to a very special day in a couple of weeks with Brian Bayless about where we're going to be talking about evangelism, let's use these couple of weeks to look at ourselves and ask ourselves, what really matters in my life? What do I care about? And I know our intellectual, our quick response, especially in this building, is going to be, I care about God. I care about God's things. And that's good. That's the right answer. You know that's the right answer. I hope that is your answer. But is it really the right answer? Is it your answer? What kind of choices are we making for God? What kind of choices are we making for ourselves? I greatly fear that the drift away from God, the drift away from the things of God, can occur so slowly and so gradually and under such quote-unquote reasonable circumstances that we may wake up one day with virtually no relationship with God or with God's people at all, and we don't even realize it. That whole thing about boiling a frog is a myth. You cannot boil a frog. That's not true. The story is you can put a frog in cold water and he's going to stay there, and you heat the water up very, very gradually, and eventually you boil the frog to death, and he's cold-blooded. He never gets the idea that he's actually in trouble, and he dies in the pot because he never comes around to getting out of danger. Frogs don't do that. Frogs are smarter than that. Human beings are not smarter than that. Human beings do that all the time. I urge you to examine yourself. Am I stronger in the faith than I was a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago? The choices that I'm making, the choices to short shrift my spiritual service, Would I have done this a year ago? Would I have done this 3 years ago? The easiest thing to examine is your contribution and your attendance. Are we making excuses for ourselves that we would not have made 3 years ago? If we are, I think this is why. I think it's because we've gotten so concerned about being angry about indifferent things that we've forgotten how to be angry about spiritual things, especially when the anger should be pointed toward ourselves. So I urge you to consider this very carefully. Apply it as you see fit in your own personal life, and hopefully help me grow as I try to help you grow, as we all try to grow closer to what Jesus is. Because being like Jesus is what it's all about. And so let's try to have Jesus kind of anger and try to avoid the kind of anger things that Jesus tended very strongly to avoid as well. We're going to offer you an opportunity to respond to the Lord's invitation if in this area or in any other area you need the help and support and guidance and forgiveness even of brothers and sisters in Christ. And if such is your need, or if you need to put Jesus on in baptism, you need to have your sins washed away, put aside the anger, the wrath that God has towards sin, and have him look toward you with grace and mercy and forgiveness. If this is your need or in any other way we can help you walk with Christ more perfectly, please respond this morning as we stand and sing to encourage you this time.